sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I think what we need to do is probably consider each group of accounts differently. Like, not everything is the same. If the prospect's going to potentially bring you five figures or six figures, you can't treat them like a multi-million dollar account. You have to give more personal relevance. You have to give more touches, more insight into what they're doing. I think that's another thing. So people that are working those bigger accounts have to probably have different metrics than the people or the sales team that's having smaller deal sizes. It can't be all the same metrics. And I think that's part of the evolution. And I'm hoping that's part of the evolution.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Christina Jaramillo. She's the founder of Personal ABM. And in today's conversation, we're going to talk about how to win, protect, and expand accounts that you want. We also dive into what Christina has identified as really sort of the largest sales problem, namely that sales is always trying to push their buyers through their process, instead of sellers helping buyers create a buying vision that's so strong that it pulls buyers, or the buyers pull sales, marketing, and account teams through their buying process. As Christina shares, short sales cycles, high margins, and high client retention rates are the common rewards for salespeople who allow their prospects to pull them into the next steps. It's all very interesting, and we're going to cover that and much, much more. But before we get to Christina, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Christina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. So you're joining us from North Carolina?
Yeah, right outside Raleigh.
Oh, that's a very pleasant area. I was there 2 years ago, keynoting at a conference, and really enjoyed it. I mean, it's just about this time of year, springtime. I think baseball season was just starting. I went over and looked, had to go look at the Bulls, the Durham Bulls.
Yes. It's a great stadium.
As a Bull Durham fan, had to go do that. It's changed quite a bit since the movie.
A little bit.
Yeah. Actually, like a great place to go see a ball game. I mean,
it is. We've gone a couple of times, and I can't wait to go back soon.
Yeah. List that on the number of activities that we all wish we could go back to pretty soon.
Seriously.
Yeah. We were talking about airplane travel, for instance, but done a little of that, but I feel more comfortable now that I'm vaccinated. So tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, so I'm president of Personal ABM, so Personal Account-Based Marketing, and we take a very micro approach to account-based marketing. Is a, you know, some people will say they're running an ABM campaign and do target maybe 200, 300 plus accounts. And we typically only target about 2 to 3 dozen at a time. And it's because they're tier one accounts. They're the ones that are going to have the greatest revenue growth opportunity, and the biggest deal sizes. And we help B2B, SaaS, tech, supply chain companies, you know, gain traction, win, protect, and expand, at-risk accounts.
Sure.
And, we've been doing that for about 10 years now. And we've just kind of honed our skills. And, you know, what we noticed is that the added relevance is really what's needed, hence Personal ABM.
Right. So what was the name of the company before ABM?
It was actually LinkedIn ABM, and it got super confusing because everyone thought we were associated with LinkedIn, and LinkedIn was just the platform that we used. But we noticed in talking to our clients that because it was approach that they took in their live settlement conversations, their email conversations, content, that it was more of a general strategy as opposed to an approach just to use on one platform. So it kind of pigeonholed us. And we just decided to evolve to that.
But you were using the word ABM 10 years ago?
10 years ago? No, we renamed ourselves 5+ years ago.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say it because it's a little more current yeah. in the usage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I like what you talk about is that, and this is certainly something I believe, I don't think it's stressed enough. And you talk about this in one of your blog posts, is that you say in most cases, you have one chance to win, protect, and expand accounts. One mistake or misfire, as you call it, and that could be it.
Yeah.
And I believe that's the case. And it starts with that first interaction that the company has with your SDR, your BDR, or whomever, right? Why do most sellers just not seem to grasp that idea that every single interaction you have is decisive?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of confused to that myself. I don't understand. I like to think of it that every touch point is like a little mini sales conversation, whether you're sharing content, whether you're providing insight, whether you're trying to teach someone a new way of approaching their business, how they do their business, how they make more money, how they, increase efficiency, whatever it is that you're trying to help them with. But every time that you communicate with someone, it's really important that you're adding value along the way, because if you're not, then chances are that people are going to fall out of the sales cycle or the funnel. They're going to stall. They're just going to go silent, or they're not going to see that you or someone who can help them achieve their goals.
You're not worth their time.
Correct.
Yeah, I tell sellers to think about it in the sense that every time, for every interaction you have with a buyer, at one level of their mind, they're calculating a return on the time they invested in you. And if you string together too many interactions that there's no value for them, there's no return for them, they gave you their time. What did you give them in exchange for that time? That's when they stop returning your phone calls. And it could be that first interaction with an SDR. I mean, it could be two, sort of check-in calls you make on somebody that just waste their time completely. And they say, look, this isn't value added for me. Is this a function of how we train people? Is that we're just not stressing the importance of...
I think it could be. Yeah, I think it's a top-down thing. I think maybe too many organizations are saying, you have to complete X amount of calls, send X amount of emails, book X amount of demos or appointments or whatever their metric is. And I think it's more of a volume game that people are playing as opposed to a quality game. And because of that, you're going to lose that value add that you were saying, because if you're, somebody's time is their most valuable asset. At least that's what I consider. So if you're wasting their time, I might give you a chance once, twice, if you're lucky, third time, probably not. So you have to make sure that every time you are touching a prospect, whether that's calling them, emailing them, however you're interacting with them, that you are adding some kind of value and that they see that it's worth a relationship worth pursuing and worth maintaining.
Yeah, I know. We've got this confusion going on in sales because on one hand, people want to say, yes, the decision is all about the buying experience and how we experience the individual seller. And to your point, on the other hand, that may be, but we're going to carpet bomb you with emails and phone calls and sometimes, and that's just on the front end of the cycle, right? It was once you get the AE involved, it could be ineffective discovery, superficial qualification, all these things that where the buyer is just like, the seller's being pushed, and the buyer's not feeling heard or understood. And once they reach that point, then it's pretty much over for you.
Yeah, that's really hard to reverse a no position or try to get someone to come out of the woodwork after they've decided to, ignore any kind of interaction that you've tried to pursue. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Bring your A game, sellers.
Always.
Every time. There's no insignificant or unimportant sales interaction they're all important. It's just, you have to have that mindset that each one could be decisive.
Absolutely.
And some people say, yeah, we can be more informal. We can be more blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, it's one thing to, you know, like I am, wear a t-shirt today on a call, but it's another thing to not be informed about the buyer, not be in touch, not trying to make an effort to understand what their concerns are, where they want to go, and so on.
Yeah, it shows right away when you're not prepared and you haven't done your homework or your background research.
Yeah. Well, which sort of gets to a problem that you identified, and I think this is something that's really important, is, and I love the perspective, is that you say the problem that exists today is that sellers are still trying to push buyers to the finish line as opposed to having the buyers pull them across the finish line. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I heard somebody mention it the other way, that you shouldn't be considering yourself a seller so much as maybe a guider. You want to guide them through the conversation. You know, I'm a big proponent of the challenger sale. And part of that is kind of teaching for differentiation, but also so that it leads back to your solution. And you give the customer, the buyer, a chance to come to the conclusion on their own, as opposed to you forcing it down their throat or pushing it onto them. So they feel like, oh, I'm the one that came to this decision. I was informed. I was taught. I was guided through the process. And it was a much better process. And when they become a customer, if, you know, hopefully they do, it's going to lead to probably a longer relationship. So not only does it help in the actual sale, but then in the customer lifetime value as well. And it just is, it starts the whole relationship on a better foot than noticing or just feeling like they were pushed into something that maybe they didn't really want to do.
Yeah. Well, I like to sort of separate this idea of persuasion from influence. Now, I know a lot of people want to conflate those terms, but I think they're distinct. Actually, if you look them up, they're quite distinct. And yeah, we treat people, use persuasion as a hammer, to your point. We're going to beat you over the head because our basic operating theory is there's only one solution for your problem, and that's us. And your problem needs to conform to our solution. Whereas to the point you were talking about is having the buyer pull is you're trying to influence choices they're making, trade-offs they're making about what is the problem, what is the size of the problem, what's the scope, the nature of the problem, things that you might challenge the buyer's paradigm on. What are the alternatives? What are the potential outcomes? And when buyers make those choices, yeah, they feel like they've made those choices themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we also have to consider that instead of pushing out tons of content, kind of confusing people, is to guide them with the content that's really relevant to them. And it makes it easier for them to digest and to understand and come to their own conclusion, as opposed to being inundated with so much information that they don't even know where to begin or how to decipher it.
Well, we seem to be getting into that mode though, where, you know, if you read, as I'm sure you do, the marketing and sales literature, it's all about more content, more content, more content, and not enough context. But on the other hand, you also have sales tools vendors saying, look, our intent is to substitute what we do for the judgment of the seller. So they're sort of trying to say, look, maybe we know best. But it's really, I think, for the seller to have the impact, to be relevant, as you talk about, they need to be that resource helping guide the buyer.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we're just so focused, especially since given 2020's craziness, to just push out more, you're right, articles, content, blog posts, white papers, emails, invites to connect, whatever it is. But I think, it feeds into that buyer's lack in confidence. And I don't think it's confidence issue with maybe the vendor, but confidence in themselves to make a decision because they can't decipher, they can't... they can't make a decision based on too much information. It's almost like they're over-informed. And we know that so many people are guiding themselves and self-teaching before they even talk to sales. So I think we have to understand that this could be, hurting us more than it's helping us. I think if you worry about the quality of content that you're giving and you actually write it or produce it for the audience that you want it to, to be relevant to, whether that's an actual named company, which is even better because you can get super targeted that way, or to, you know, a position or a role that's having a certain challenge that you've seen in several organizations. But I don't think that it's a matter of a numbers game. Every time marketing and sales plays a numbers game, I think we wind up shooting ourselves in the foot.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. It's because you talked about when you work with clients, you take the target lists down to a much smaller number. And yet, yeah, it's not unusual. You know, I talk to companies, I'll talk about, yeah, we've got 600, we've got 1,000 names on our target list or something, and they're counting, you know, frequency of contact within the, you know, tracking all the metrics, you know, engagement metrics within individuals within those accounts. You're saying that's too broad.
No, I think it's needed to do that, but maybe for your tier two and tier three, but I think you need to have more of a diverse approach. That's why we work with the tier ones, because, you know, typically marketing will help sales maybe get some marketing qualified leads, sales qualified leads. But if they really want to close those bigger deals, they're going to have a much targeted, much more relevant and personal context for those tier one accounts. You know, it's something that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of resources. So you better know that that account is, you know, worth all of those things. Mm-hmm. And it has to be a named account. It can't just say that it fits certain criteria. It has to be, you know, I'd like to really close Oracle, but there has to be a reason why I want to work with them, because I know that I have this customer success story. I have these results. I have this case study. I have this insight into what is going on in that organization that I can help them with, as opposed to saying, you know, a lot of salespeople that are maybe either new to the field or maybe just a little more ambitious go for big named accounts that they have no relevance with or no, you know, no experience with. Like, everyone wants to work with Oracle. Everyone would love to work with Google, Amazon, all the big names. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have anything to speak to them, that's going to, you know, make them see how you can help them because you have experience helping organizations that are saving, you know, facing different similar challenges, or, you know, we're going through different things that are similar to what they're facing, then it's just not going to work.
Yeah. I mean, there's virtue in focus, right? In narrowing your niche. And especially when you're talking about from this personal ABM perspective, which is that you really do get personal. You talk about creating a human bond with the right people within the account. And that's sort of unfashionable these days to some degree. In some quarters,
people
you know, dismiss this idea of personal connections and the need to be able to develop those.
I think it's because it's not scalable, or they see it as not scalable. And what I come back with when someone says that, because, you know, it's too hard, it's too much work. And yeah, it is, but it's also going to give you the most return. And so what you do is whatever approach you're taking with these tier ones, whatever you're learning, experiencing, seeing what's working or not working, doing that kind of testing and seeing what is moving things forward in deals and expansion conversations, you can then kind of scale it to the other campaign. So it's going to help your tier two and tier three accounts, whether sales and marketing, you know, can learn from the results from tier one. So it's not that it's not scalable. It's just how you use that information.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get back to this idea about buyers pulling the sellers too, because one of the items you guys talk about a lot is this idea of the buying vision, which you don't hear talked much about. Actually, you know, Forrester did a study on it, I think 7-8 years ago. They talked about, you know, if you're the seller that is the first to present this compelling buying vision, let's say, I don't think they used the word compelling, but to the buyer, excuse me, then your odds of winning the deal went up pretty substantially, like 65%, I think they talked about. So as virtue in being first across the line with this buying vision that the buyer buys into. So describe what that buying vision is. What are you trying to achieve with the buyer to create this?
So it's, you know, I think about it as, you know, how people, marketing usually is focusing on people that are in market, maybe shown intent, sure, you know, things like that. But that's a small percentage. And if you go down to the middle of everything that prospect wise, it's like 60% of the market that's stuck in status quo. So 60% of the market that doesn't even know they have a problem, doesn't even realize that there's an issue, doesn't realize that there's a better way of doing things that they've been, you know, how better make them more successful in their job, let's say. So if you can create that buying vision, explain to them what they're doing that they didn't maybe know. So think of, give them a new way of looking at something, give them a new way of perceiving how they handle their day-to-day job. I mean, part of that buying vision is showing them a new way to think, showing them a new way of approaching it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes to the guiding through that we were talking about, as opposed to pushing it through and just saying, you know, pushing your company, pushing your generic benefits, your generic features. And that creates a differentiation.
Could be generic insights, even. I mean, I think that's
exactly
to reach that point is, you know, to me, I think a lot of companies would, sellers would hear all this idea of a buying vision. Well, that's something I got from marketing and I'm going to tell you that. And it's like, well, no, this is an outcome of the work you're doing with the account to really understand, you know, the problem they're trying to solve, help them understand the problem they're trying to solve, help them understand the alternatives that exist for solving it, the alternative outcomes they potentially could achieve. The buying vision's not, hey, that's not something I don't lead with the buying vision. This is something that's developed collaboratively.
Yes, absolutely. And I think also has to be, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to say takes place later in the cycle.
Yeah, it's not the first interaction for sure.
No.
Yeah, and I think people also have to figure out, you know, a lot of reasons, a lot of problems with people, prospects maybe not seeing the vision or not going into the vision is you're not giving them the reason of to change or what the, if you put it into perspective, what happens if they don't change? Like, this is what they're leaving on the table money-wise, efficiency-wise, whatever it is that you're trying to explain to them. Because change is always hard. It's always difficult. And you have to show the pain of not changing versus the pain of changing.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing with the buying vision, though, is that it is a stage. It should be a stage in your sales process. Yeah, if you've got stages listed in, you know, typical linear fashion, it is a stage. If you're not conscious about driving towards the buyer agreeing to the buying vision, it's not going to happen. I mean, often you may win deals without it, but I mean, in general, if you'll be much more effective, is getting the buyer to buy into what that buying vision is as a very deliberate step is really important. And that's oftentimes requires, at least on larger deals, is that even working through the business case with them, right? So to your point, what's the cost of not taking action? Well, once you quantify what you may potentially achieve by the investment in whatever solution you're selling, the vision starts to become pretty compelling.
Absolutely. And I think another important aspect of that is this is a chance that you can have to explain the cost of maybe going with a competitor or going with an alternative solution, or maybe, you know, if they think that they can bring this solution in-house, what's the cost of doing that versus going to another vendor for help or another provider?
Yeah. Well, again, it's, I'm a huge believer that you really don't have a qualified opportunity until they've quantified the value of what they can achieve with the solution that you're proposing.
Yeah. And I think another thing that you have to, or sellers should take into consideration is that you arm the buyers with information to quantify that when they're having internal conversations that you can't be a part of, that you're not privy to. So if you can arm them with the quantifiable data or the, you're going to have a better chance of moving that to a deal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most of those conversations take place out of earshot of sellers. But I think that sort of talks to a sort of perspective, though, that comes from what you're talking about in terms of the pull versus the push, customer-led, sort of buyer-led. Is that's just a change in perspective about what the roles in sales are. You know, I was having a conversation with somebody where we were talking about specialized sales roles, and we understand the value of those, but you think about how we set them up is, you know, oftentimes since we've got our appointment setters, the SDRs, BDRs, and then people say, yeah, then it transitions to the closers. And I'm like, okay, well, where are the sellers in here?
We're missing a key part.
Yeah. But that speaks to the attitude, right? About the push that you talk about specifically is, look, we're going to create or identify potentially an opportunity, and then we're going to give it to somebody whose job is to push somebody across the finish line just by the way we conceptualize the role. I mean, even I've had, I don't know, three conversations last week. I was writing. I keep knocking my microphone over. You'd think after 925 of these, I wouldn't be doing that still. But, wow, you got to see it twice in one day. you'd think after everything that's going on that people would sort of understand that's just not the way we label things and the way people feel labeled and the roles they think they're filling have an enormous impact on the way the job gets done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because then it becomes just like, I'm going to push it down your throat until you close. And if not, I'm just go to the next one. And it's not a good, like, you would not want to be sold that way. If you flip the situation for a second, you would not want to be sold that way. You would not want to purchase that way. And if you did, just because you had to, chances are you're not going to want to stay that long.
But I think we see the impact of this, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, nothing is always 100% one way or another, right? You can still be a pushy, persuasion-oriented, quote-unquote closer type. You're still going to win business. I mean, you could be unpleasant to deal with, but you know, if you have a modicum of competence, you're going to win some deals. But I think the issue, at least in the tech sector these days, is they leave so much opportunity on the table. Win rates are so low that it's like, why are you bothering? Right? Why don't you re-engineer your process and say, look, to your point, is we can more targeted. We know that if we operate in a certain way, we're going to yield a certain win rate. But let's scale that at a higher win rate than sort of the way we do it now.
I think that it would just because the mass way of doing it, the numbers game is it's going to work for a certain amount of time until it doesn't work. And I think we're getting to that point if we haven't already, and definitely in some sectors. But if you're, no one's going to invest 6, 7, 8 figures if you push the solution and the features and benefits down their throat. It's just not going to happen. You have to actually give them some value.
Shocking. What a shocking perspective.
Rocket science.
Yeah. Well, but it's, I've talked about that on the show before, is conversations with CROs of, you know, big SaaS companies that are just not focused on this effectiveness side of things. I mean, not defined in the same way I do in terms of, look, if I've got 5 highly qualified opportunities, why should I only be winning one of them? And why is that acceptable? I mean, you can be honest, to your point earlier, yeah, you could scale that for a while, but at some point, that's just not going to work anymore.
Yeah, you're going to hit a wall eventually.
Yeah, I don't know. How do you get people? Do they have to hit the wall before they come to their senses?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. It's sometimes I feel like that when people come to us, they're like, you know what? We're just not getting sales anymore, or we're not getting the amount that we'd like. Mm-hmm. We're keeping what we have. We're getting tons of demos and we're getting tons of, you know, prospect calls, but no one's coming through. And then we kind of step back and reevaluate and say, well, are they even the right people? Are you speaking to people that are the best fit? Or, you know, it's amazing to me how many people or how many organizations think that they have an ideal customer profile, but if you ask them what it is, you'll get multiple answers, or you'll get something so broad that it's not really focused enough. And I think it's just a lack of focus. I think sales and marketing are both guilty of just being all over the place.
Yeah, definitely. I think that can be the case in many companies. And some of that seems to emanate from the fact that you see this oftentimes in SaaS is that, you know, our goal is ultimately to be able to sell, you know, company will say, founder will say, like, ultimately to sell to larger enterprises, but we're going to, you know, start with the SMB and work our way up to mid-market and so on. And my advice is always to those companies is, well, if you want to sell to big companies, go sell to big companies. Be more targeted from the inception.
Have lofty goals. It's totally possible. We worked with a startup that was like basically a nobody in the supply chain and logistics tech side. And they, just because they flipped the script, changed the conversation with the prospect, they were able to, you know, outwin Oracle in that same space. And they were a startup that had maybe 10 employees.
Right.
And so it's just because they changed the conversation, and that's something that they can do. If they can win or business from a company than Oracle, then other organizations can do it. But it's just a matter of having those blinders on, that you're focused on the end goal and not just everything.
Yeah, I think it's sort of been this mythology for a lot of tech companies over the years, is that, yeah, we have to earn our spur, earn our stripes, yada, yada, yada. And I grew some startups and worked with startups where we grew that, yeah, our product was only good for big companies. So let's go sell big companies and sell against the big brand names and win. Because, yeah, we flipped the conversation. We challenged their assumptions. We forced them to look at the problem they were trying to solve differently. It really turned out to be a different problem they were trying to solve. And by virtue of identifying that, it made sense to go with us versus the other guys. And the customer pulled us across the finish line in that respect, as you talk about. It's not that hard. I mean, it's hard work.
Yeah, it's hard work. But if it's something that's worth doing, it's going to be hard work. So
yeah.
And sales was never, no one's ever said that sales is easy. So.
Well, that's not true, actually.
Yeah, you think people have said it. Tech and SaaS. Yeah,
so I was reading LinkedIn last week, and one of the thought leaders out there said, look, sellers, if you practice every day, you know, in 5 years or 10 years, sales is going to be as easy as, I don't know, I think the term was like a hot knife through butter. Mm. And I was sitting there thinking, well, that's just complete and utter nonsense. I mean, sales is never easy. Yeah, anybody's listening, sales is never easy. It becomes simpler, and there's a big distinction between that, right?
Absolutely.
And that's what your experience gets you. Sales becomes simpler because you understand more what's going on. You understand what's going to happen. But don't ever kid yourself into thinking it's ever going to become easy. It's hard. Sales is hard. It's always hard. But if you can make it simpler, and the analogy I draw is, I don't know, are you a sports fan?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what's your favorite sport?
Ooh, it's a tie between baseball and football. So go either way. We're in baseball season.
We'll use football as the... But when you hear college athletes go into the pros, what do they say is their biggest adjustment? The speed of the game, right?
And so, totally different thing, yeah.
It requires them to think differently and react more quickly and so on. But then they reach a point, and you hear interviews with athletes, and they're football players, baseball players, whatever. It's like, well, yeah, the game has finally slowed down for me. You hear that expression all the time. The game has slowed down, meaning they understand what's happening, right? They understand where they're supposed to be. They understand the philosophy, both on offense and defense and so on. And that's what you want to try to accomplish in sales, is you want sales to sort of slow down, right? It starts being a little more simple. You experience, you understand. But, sorry, didn't mean to go my soapbox, but it's never going to be easy.
No, it totally is. And I think that whole, quantity game that we're talking about, of just adding tons of more information out there, is something that I think people think that they need to do. But if they stop for a second and kind of breathe and slow down, like you were saying, then everything does become simpler. It's never going to be easy, but it's going to be more clear that you're going to see the path to what you need to do, as opposed to just, you know, if I send out 100 emails, one of them's going to stick, right?
Well, but don't we serve collectively as a sales industry, we put sellers in a tough position, though, because, you know, increasingly, since everything's so metrics driven, and granted, it's always been metrics in sales, right? Everybody's had their numbers, right? How many calls do I have to make to have so many qualified opportunities, to have prospects and so on, proposals all the way through. Hey, it's been that way since I started way too long ago. But now there's such reliance on that, and you have the pipeline coverage ratios that AEs have to maintain that make it very difficult for them to spend the appropriate amount of time they need with their, especially larger opportunities, right? To make sure that they can work the deal effectively in a way that's not pushing, but in helping enable the buyer to make a good choice. Yeah, they're sort of stuck oftentimes. And yeah, I did this calculation a couple of years ago, went back and looked and saw my average pipeline coverage ratio, and it was generally less than 2. But I won a high fraction of my deals because they were extremely qualified. And I know sellers even today that are operating on similar pipelines, big SaaS deals, right? It's possibly done, but I mean, how do sellers sort of get themselves in a position to sort of have this autonomy to operate in a way that aligns with what you talk about?
Yeah, I think it's definitely has to come from a top-down kind of approach. We have to reevaluate those metrics. I think, you know, some of these sales metrics are a little outdated. I mean, just because I send 500, you know, emails in a week doesn't mean I'm going to get anything. But if I worry about those interactions and every little touch point and the quality and the fact that it's moving from one interaction to the next, I think that's what we need to focus on is those personal interactions, right, and not these stale metrics. And I understand they have to be there. Otherwise, you know, there's nothing that holds you accountable, but I think they should be focused on both.
Yeah. Well, and I'd had this conversation again, related to this not that long ago about, yeah, I mean, I look at sales not as this linear stream of events, but as a collection of moments that aggregate to somebody making a choice or a decision about for your product is, yeah, how do we measure the quality of those moments? Because those are actually more insightful than just, yeah, we've fulfilled an exit criteria, we're moving on to the next stage. It speaks nothing about the quality of what's happened.
Yeah, I think, I think the focus of the quality is so important that that's how you're going to get to that end deal. But I think also when you, just because someone clicked on your email doesn't really say they opened it doesn't mean it's an interaction. Just because they downloaded a white paper doesn't mean that they're ready to buy or there is an interaction. You have to actually see, you know, I think since intent data is something that's becoming more and more popular, right, you have to go beyond that intent and see, you know, what is it that, what's behind it? Why are they doing it? What's happening in the organization? What's happening in their department? What's happening in their industry with their customers? Are they serving organizations or industries that are being really hit by the economic turndown or some other reason? You have to do more homework. You can't just say, oh, they like that content. Let's, or they like this information. Let's send them more of the same. You have to actually think about
it. What are you talking about? That's exactly what happened.
More.
Well, but I think you raise a larger issue, which we've touched on, is just, yeah, how do we evolve from where we are today? And yeah, I think the ship is taking on water. And we've sort of been in this sort of model, I won't label, but certainly in the tech space for 20 years now. It's not going to be forever. We see the shortcomings. Companies are evolving away from it in various ways. What do you see is going to happen?
That we're evolving from the pushing down too much info?
Yeah, well, I call it basically sort of the predictable revenue model. The way we structure, especially working bigger deals, it's got to be a better way to structure deals, maybe more team approaches, more nodes, more something. I mean, it just seems like we haven't evolved enough. And I'm just wondering what your insights you have on where you think it's going to go.
I'm hoping that it continues to evolve. And I think what we need to do is probably consider each group of accounts differently. Like not everything is the same. If a client is potentially, or a prospect's going to potentially bring you 5 figures or 6 figures, you can't treat them like a multi-million dollar account. You have to give more personal relevance. You have to give more touches, more insight into what they're doing. I think that's another thing. So people that are working those bigger accounts have to probably have different metrics than the people or the sales team that's having smaller deal sizes. It can't be all the same metrics. And I think that's part of the evolution. And I'm hoping that's part of the evolution.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not sure myself, you know, where it's headed, because we certainly have all these other influences in terms of, you know, increasing levels of automation in sales, more AI, obviously tools coming in to enable sellers to have different quality of conversations perhaps with buyers, but I don't think it's not obviously not a end all be all solution. But yeah, we hear this sort of conflicting data points, if you will, is on one hand, people are saying, well, you know, buyers are more self-service oriented. They want more of a consumer type experience in the B2B world, which quite honestly they've sort of had increasingly anyway. It's been evolving. But at the same time, they also talk about, yeah, the experiential part of it's really important and we do need to talk to sellers. But it's like, yeah, but who do they need to talk to at what time? Yeah, I just think there's a lot of sort of moving pieces that it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. Because I still, at the end of the day, think that, I think as perhaps you do, is that the human seller is still going to be at the center of it all. But they have to be better than they are today.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to constantly be better. But I think you just know that you're dealing with someone, when you're dealing with a prospect, they're probably more educated than you think they are. So you have to in turn be just as educated about their business and their challenges and their gaps and their, you know, their needs in order to move that conversation forward.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think there's no doubt about that, is that the sellers are, buyers are more educated. They don't necessarily have more understanding. They have more knowledge.
Understanding is different. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the role of the seller is, you know, how do you help a buyer move from having knowledge about things to having understanding about things, whether it's, as I said, the nature of the problem or the nature of the outcomes they can achieve. And that's still, to your point, is for an educated seller, that's the place where you're going to add value.
Absolutely. And again, have to be every touch point adding value so that you can move them forward. Because it's going to be, you know, we deal with people that have really pretty lengthy sales cycles. So each stage, each touch has to have that value. Otherwise, someone you've been working on for 6 months can just go at the very end because you didn't add value.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of work thrown out the window.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea that value is measured in progress. Right? That as a result of an interaction, if the buyer is not, even in a small step, not closer to making a decision than they were before the interaction, then did you deliver anything of value? And I'd argue no, right? It's progress. How are you helping them move forward?
Yeah, and what can you do to try to fix that before it's too late? Because if they're not moving forward from each interaction, I mean, ideally, that's what you'd like. They can stall a little bit, but if they're stalled too much, then that's going to be the big problem to overcome.
That is the death knell, absolutely. All right, well, Christina, we've run out of time, but thank you for your time today. And if people want to connect with you or learn more about what you guys are doing, what's the best way to do that?
Connect with me on LinkedIn. Give me some reason as to why you want to connect. That'd be really helpful. Mm-hmm. Also, check out my website, personalabm.com. And we also have a podcast that you're going to be on, Andy.
I am,
at
yes.
Stopthesalesdrop.com. That's a community. It's all free. Podcasts, articles, videos, just a bunch of knowledge for B2B sellers and marketers. So check that out as well, stopthesalesdrop.com.
Yeah, I like the urgency of the name.
Thank you.
It's a good title. All right, Christina, thank you very much. Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, we're so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Christina Jaramillo, for sharing her insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So again, thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations. And after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.